You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Ladies and gentlemen, come and dream with me.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star.
You're OG, and I feel fine.
Well, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pig, you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Wait a minute, I'm a reasonable guy, but I've just experienced some very unreasonable things.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. As always, many thanks to Ian Dayborn for the past couple of hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, an extraordinary exploration into the lost city of zealous film reviews. My name is Yossi Osman, and joining me in the studio today are Bridget Bradshaw.
Hello.
Rosie Applin.
Hello.
Mark Baylor.
Hello.
And Ben Challoner.
Good afternoon.
Today's busy show starts with a fairy tale and ends with a true story. We'll look at Beauty and the Beast, Disney's live-action remake of their 1991 animated classic. Kristen Stewart drifts in a strange world between celebrity and the supernatural in Personal Shopper. Horror movie Get Out suggests that something strange is afoot in white picket fence America. An Oscar winner for Best Foreign Film, The Salesman, depicts a life torn asunder by assault. And an obsession for discovery leads a good man astray in the lost city of Zed. Plus, as we look forward to Ben Wheatley's visit to the Cambridge Arts Picture House to promote his new film Free Fire, we replay our interview with that film's composer, Ben Salisbury. And we preview A Quiet Dream, screening this coming Monday as part of what is planned to be a series of Cambridge screenings of new cinema from South Korea. So, lots to come, but first, we have a tale as old as time.
My dear Belle, you're so ahead of your time. This is a small village.
You are the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen. Nobody deserves you.
And it's small-minded as well. But small also means safe.
I've come for my father.
He's a thief.
Come into the light. I will escape, I promise.
Look, a girl.
Who said that?
Hello.
You can talk.
Hello, Court. It's all he ever does. What did you do to it?
Nothing.
Get out of here! Go!
It's fast becoming a cinema tradition to start the spring with a Disney do-over. As the studio remakes almost all their animated features as live-action blockbusters. This year, it's the turn of the much-loved 1991 musical classic Beauty and the Beast. This new Beauty and the Beast stars Emma Watson as a spirited Belle who longs for a life more exciting than being the only person in the village who reads books. After coming to the rescue of her father, she finds herself prisoner of the Beast, a monster who lives in a castle of eternal winter and magically talking furniture. Belle refuses to fear the beast, sensing that his sharp claws and ferocious roar mask a deep and mysterious melancholy. Rosie, we'll start with you. I'm going to start with a rather blunt question, actually, considering this is another Disney remake. Should this film exist?
It's a really good question. And actually, it's interesting because I was reading earlier that there are many, many other Disney live-action remakes coming up soon. So obviously, this is setting a bit of a trend. I personally thoroughly enjoyed it, and the main reason why is that it was almost identical to the original, which I also loved. So it was pretty much a scene-by-scene remake. Should it exist? I don't know that it necessarily has to exist, but I'm happy that it does because I found it sort of charming and magical, much like I found the original. You know, it has its flaws, but essentially I thoroughly loved it. So, yeah, I think it should exist.
Okay. I mean, I saw Beauty and the Beast when I was a kid and I loved it. It's got these really... And watching the film, there are these moments which bring you back to sort of the past and nostalgia, and it's really lovely. But Bridget, I know you were saying that you were at university when it came out, so it might have struck you slightly differently to perhaps me or Rosie. I don't know if you want to go into that.
Yeah, so it's not something I've grown up with. In fact, I saw the Cocteau La Belle et la Bête before I saw the animated version. So a lot of the things like the animated furniture, the sort of hand candelabra details were familiar to me. Most of my Beauty and the Beast memories are reading a little book made out of paper in the 1970s. Yeah, I'm not its target audience. Mm. It was. Although I did engage with it, and at the end I did cry at the teapot, which I wasn't expecting.
Cried at the teapot. Oh, sorry.
I did. It was very sad.
Talking about target audience, I don't know if Mark, you want to weigh in on this. Is this a film that it helps to have seen the Disney animated classic, or do you think that will hinder the experience of seeing this new live action remake?
I think it stands alone by itself. I think I don't think there's any you'd necessarily gain anything by having watched the animated original, other than a bit of nostalgia. I think it's I guess going back to a certain extent to your question about, you know, does this film need to exist? Well, I guess it's sort of for a new generation in a way, and I think it has its own charm that's very similar to the animation, but I think you can watch it on its own and enjoy it and get a lot from it. I think it's a decent enough film in its own right, even though it is a virtual scene-by-scene remake. Mm. You know, I did enjoy it, and it reminded me a bit of the animated original, but as I say, I didn't find myself, you know, longing for the original, although I'd quite like to see it again, having seen this. Mm. I think it's a pretty faithful portrayal and a decent film.
It is faithful. There are, you know, it is almost a scene-by-scene remake. There are some additions to the film. Thinking about, there's the backstory with Belle and her father and their kind of urban lifestyle before they moved into this little village with all these village people. Rosie, what do you think this added to the film? Did it add anything?
I think it was necessary, to be honest, to add a bit of padding because, you know, it's a long film. It felt like it needed to have a bit of backstory. I know there's been a bit of criticism from some people saying, well, you know, why do they have to make such a big deal about the fact that she's come from Paris? And, you know, is she some sort of urban metropolitan person that these kind of provincial country folks
wants
just
to escape provincial
just,
life?
Yeah, exactly. She wants to escape that provincial life. But, you know, is it sort of being a bit critical of the provincial country folk? And, you know, is there an element of snobbery going on there, perhaps? But I felt like it did work, actually, the kind of Parisian backstory, especially in terms of, you know, her dad. There was quite a lot of heartstrings being pulled there with the story of what happened to her mum, which wasn't covered in the original, I don't think. I think it added a certain depth, which otherwise it could have all seemed a little bit flat without. So I think it worked.
I think it's nice as well to kind of emphasise the sort of loneliness, which perhaps isn't emphasised as much in the original Disney, so that Belle and the Beast have a bit more in common. They're both these two sort of standoffish, lonely figures that don't quite fit in with their surroundings. So I did kind of appreciate that as an addition. Mm. What about the extra songs? Because those are things I did not quite appreciate.
I've got to be honest, I wasn't really keen on the... I just wanted the old songs, the ones I knew, that had the lyrics and the tunes that I liked. I was like, what's this? Where's this coming from? I mean, they were probably fine, but...
Bridget, you're a fan of your songs. What did you think of the extras?
I couldn't tell which ones were new, actually. I remember the Gaston one and the Provincial Town, but I couldn't... tell.
Speaking of Gaston, what did we think of Luke Evans? He was pretty awesome.
Yeah, he was very good. He was excellent. I must admit, there were moments when I sort of had almost flashbacks to the cartoon, picturing, you know, the Gaston in the original. But I did think he was very good. You know, he really sold that part well. And the scene in the village, in the tavern and stuff like that, was excellent. Really good. A bit sort of musical theatre, I suppose, but yeah, it was very good. I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. I think he was born to play that role, actually. He was just fantastic. he was definitely the best thing about the whole film, I'd say.
Yeah, he did own it. And Emma Watson as the lead, how did we feel she did as Belle?
I think something I found interesting in comparing the live action to the animation is the way you get slightly different character interaction when you've actually got humans looking at each other rather than cartoon characters. Sometimes this worked really well and you got a great feeling of connection between them, but a lot of the time I felt it was more like watching a musical. Mm. Quite stagey, quite yellow brick roady. She didn't really sell me as that character. Mm. Her dad though, brilliant. Mm. Kevin Kline was so much depth and range.
It was good. I really don't want to say this because I really wanted to like her in it, but I found her a little bit uneven at times. Mm. So sometimes I completely forgot that she was Emma Watson doing the role of Belle. Other times I was very aware of it. Mm. And that was a bit of a shame. Mm. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought...
You don't have to apologise. She's not here.
I thought she was good. I mean, I must admit, I had heard some criticism of her going into the film, so I sort of went in with a, you know, perhaps with some low expectations of her performance, and I thought it was fine. I didn't see her as, sort of, say, Hermione or something like that. You know, I thought she played this was a different role. So the only thing I would say, I didn't think the bits where she's meant to be all sort of charming and radiant felt a little bit kind of forced. It didn't feel natural to me. It wasn't like it felt like she was almost trying too hard.
It was the sincerity eyebrows, which is an issue I have with that.
That came across a little bit. It wasn't a naturally charming sort of character in that way. But, yeah, I think it was fine. And then, you know, we're not target audiences for the next generation, I guess, of kids, really. And I can't imagine that they would have any issue with it at all.
No, I think, you know, she holds the film well. And, you know, you've got this cast of the sort of inanimate objects who actually, for me, the best part of the film was when they were revealed as who they were. I didn't know who the cast was and I was like, oh wow, it's Emma Thompson. How much did they add to the film with their voices and the sort of characterisation of all these cute little objects?
So, well, is it Ian McKellen that played Cogsworth? Mm-hmm. He was fantastic. I didn't know it was him either. So I had the same joyous moment of revelation at the end. I was like, oh, of course, I didn't get that. He was great. I'm a big fan of Ian, but I must admit I wasn't 100% sold on the French accent, which he did as Lumiere. Sorry again for that, Ewan, but if you're listening. So that was a bit of an issue. But otherwise, Emma Thompson, top notch. She was great.
Especially in the credits at the end when you see the humans and she came out like, hello, I'm Emma Thompson, a national treasure.
She is a national treasure. Emma, if you're listening, we love you. I'm sure we have plenty more to say, but we'll crack on. Beauty and the Beast opened last week and is now screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate PG. Cambridge 105. This coming Monday evening, the Arts Picture House screens A Quiet Dream, the new romantic drama from Vital Korean filmmaker Zhang Liu. The film is the first in a series of screenings planned over the next few months, arranged by the Cambridge Film Trust in conjunction with the London Korean Film Festival, to bring a range of the best new Korean cinema to Cambridge. To find out more about A Quiet Dream and to get the lowdown on current Korean cinema, Bums on Seats host Toby Miller spoke to film academic Dr. Mark Morris. Dr. Morris spoke about the success of homegrown cinema in Korea and how the country's filmmakers offer much, much more than revenge thrillers and ghost stories. But first, Dr. Morris spoke about how the title of A Quiet Dream isn't a direct translation from the Korean.
So 솔직히 얘기해. 어? 우리 셋 중에 누구랑 잤어?
내가 누구랑 자도 무슨 상관이에요?
근데 왜 저랑 잤다고 얘기했어요?
자긴 잤지.
You know, there's a whole art and craft of turning East Asian film titles into something that will communicate more simply in English. In this instance, this isn't really a great trick. I think quiet, because they want to capture the mood of the film. Literally, Chungmong, Spring Dream in Korean, sounds slightly erotic and like it could be a very old-fashioned, strange sort of film set in the past. So Quiet Dream seems to be quite safe, actually. Quite a good compromise.
Well, to begin with A Quiet Dream, if when you read the synopsis of the film, they make it sound as if it's straightforward social realism because it deals with characters that are on sort of the fringes of Korean society, whether it's through their disability or their sexuality, or one suffers from a bipolar condition. Is that fair on the film? Is it much more than that?
Well, it's not necessarily more, it's just entirely other. Zhang Lu has made some films that deal in a much more straightforward way, in a realistic, almost quasi-documentary fashion with people on the fringes of society. This particular film, although it features people very much on the fringes, one character who's quite a bit of a spiv, a gangster who wants to, seems he might want to go straight, a fellow who is a North Korean refugee. These people come into a story and in a framework that's much more like something out of Beckett or Waiting for Godot than anything ultimately realistic. These three down and outers hover around a young woman, and she is their muse, sort of the point of gravity for the entire film. And if anything, it's a kind of quiet, strange exploration of character with a lot of humor. It doesn't dwell on injustice or anything. There's no political line whatsoever in the film. And that's what's kind of refreshing about it.
This is Zhang Lu's 13th film, I think.
It's the 11th feature.
11th feature, two short films, and this is his 11th feature. How does it fit into that filmography? He has a fairly minimalist style, I think, but it seems to be getting a little bit more playful, perhaps.
I think he's finding his feet and relaxing a bit, because consider this, here he is. He became a writer, first of all, and of course, in a way, his home language was always Korean, but his first cultural and social language is Chinese. So he became a writer, he started making short films, and he had some miraculous connections. He met up with some people who supported his first film efforts. So he's had a lot of luck. And if his films are minimalist earlier, it's just a lack of money, among other things. And what people love, I think, about the quirkiness of Quiet Dream is that you never quite know what he's going to come up with. And I think there is still room within the big money productions of South Korea for this kind of quirky, smaller scale inventiveness.
Part of the reason for this season, for this strand, hopefully, of Korean films that the Cambridge Picture House is going to be showing over the next few months, is to give films that normally wouldn't be seen a chance to be seen. Korean cinema is unusual in that, for some aspects of world cinema, in that we do see some Korean cinema in the UK, but the distribution does tend to focus on genre films. Is this a help or a hindrance in trying to draw attention to Korean filmmakers? Is that the fact that there is an audience, but the audience tends to be rather specialized on genre?
Well, there's two audiences. There is an old audience that was fostered by the first importations of film, often in the form of DVD, and that was the Asia Extreme brand that was established by the now-defunct Tarjan Video people, both in the U.S. and in the U.K. The idea was that there was a kind of extreme film coming out of East Asia, and this might include Japanese horror, like The Ring and The Ring Cycle, but it also fitted into it one of the first breakthrough films called Old Boy by Park Chan-wook, one of the most successful of all directors, even now in Korea. So there was an emphasis on violence and action. There was some sort of vague sense that whatever the Koreans were doing was somewhere lost between Japanese horror and maybe Hong Kong action film. It took a long time for that blur to kind of become a clearer image. And so gradually there's been a widening out. And it seems to me that there's a wide range of critics who are alert now to the fact that Korea just is in action. One of the hugest types of film in Korea from really the very outset in the silent years up to the present are things like melodrama and comedy. This was all missed out initially, but one of the things that we're trying to do at the Arts Picture House is give us kind of sampler, a taster of the variety of films that we will be focusing on at the big Central Film Festival, which is always held in each autumn.
There's a wide variety of genres that are placed across the Korean box office: thrillers, gangster films, horror, melodramas, and comedies, as you mentioned. But I wondered if Korean cinema had an identifiable flavour in Asian cinema. It's a heavily urbanised country. It's an affluent country with a wealthy middle class. These things tend to affect the cinema that is made. Is that the case here, do you think?
Well, I think it's just the sheer success of having so many, such a wide audience to draw upon. Sure, the 20-somethings to early 30s were catered for in many ways, but a lot of films are aimed at an older audience and still pulling them in. I can't, the experience of being at a Korean multiplex where there's, say, 4 to 6 screens and there's a film about young romance, over here a historical epic, over there an action and whatnot, and to see these people of all ages and whatnot pouring into these cinemas is extraordinary. I think over 200 million Koreans in a population of less than 60 million bought a film ticket last year. It's extraordinary success.
Again, reading up on it, it seemed to me there might be a slight danger in the current model, which is, as you've just been saying, is hugely successful. But is there a danger similar to what's happening in America, in that there's the blockbusters that we've mentioned, and there seems to be a flourishing independent scene, low-budget independent scene, but there's not being much made in the middle, budget-wise?
That's exactly right. No, I'm speaking like a cheerleader. Now I've got to go back and put my brain, in a different gear. The business is awash with money. The big corporations, there are three huge filmmaking enterprises that also control, often almost in a form of vertical integration, the production, distribution, and exhibition, the actual cinemas and whatnot. So if you can make a film, and there are funds available and support to make films on a low budget, but whether you can find a niche in a schedule to show your film or not, it's very hard to say. When a big studio releases a big budget film, they will block book 700, 800 cinemas for whatever week or two that they want. So there is a terrible squeeze on. Something like over 330 films were technically released last year, but the number of people who saw anything but the top 30 or 40 is extremely limited. Yeah, there is a real problem, and this has been complained about, worried about, compared to where Korean was on its knees, Korean cinema was, say, just in the mid-90s. This is extraordinary. No one could have predicted anything like this. I don't think there's a parallel phenomenon anywhere where a smallish, medium-sized country has a cinema that can beat Hollywood on its own terms. It's an extraordinary thing. And as I say, it's done without quotas or without interference or whatnot. It's the Korean moviegoer's choice. that that's what they want to see. But there's been a leveling out, as I say, the corporatization of things, the similar look, the slick, polished look of Korean film is absolutely the envy of filmmakers in many parts of the world. However, are people still saying, you know, telling stories that matter? Are they talking about things significant socially? Are they talking about matters that will communicate to an international audience? And are they using the medium inventively, or are rather they producing a slick product that will pull in the, you know, predicted required amount of income in order to keep the machine rolling over? It's really hard to say. I can think of many examples of very promising young directors who were gobbled up into the machine and really never reappear from, you know, the happy skies of big profit. So I myself, one of my alibis for why I'm still so enthusiastic about Korean film after 15 years of diving my head in head first, is that there are independent filmmakers, there are possibilities for really good films to get out. They're limited, but at least they're being made.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Mark Morris for the interview. A Quiet Dream screens this coming Monday, so that's the 27th of March, at the Arts Picture House, starting at 9 p.m. with an introduction from Dr. Mark Morris. As always, you can get more information from the Picture House website, www.picturehouses.com, or by just popping into the cinema. Cambridge 105. In his 30-year career, French director Olivier Assayas has leapt from genre to genre like a filmmaking gazelle. His last film, The Cloud Size Maria, mixed backstage rivalry with an examination of age. And his new film, Personal Shopper, is a deliberately uneasy blend of high fashion and the supernatural. Kristen Stewart plays Maureen Cartwright, an American working in Paris as a wardrobe assistant to a big-name celebrity. This busy world of haute couture and Cartier jewellery contrasts with Maureen's increasingly fraught private life. Gifted with an ability to sense the presence of the spirit world, she spends solitary evenings in a large empty house, looking for any sign from her recent deceased twin brother.
My twin brother Louis died here.
It's been 95 days.
We made this oath. Whoever died first would send the other a sign.
From the afterlife.
Has that always been there?
Louis, are you here? I had a sign.
Are you sure?
There was a presence.
Do you think Louis is here?
I don't know. Kira?
I'm just gonna drop these bags for you, okay?
Hey. I'm lost. I can't tell whether or not I'm going crazy.
Louis, is it you?
Well, Ben, I'll come to you. There's a very unsettling feeling throughout Personal Shopper. How well is this executed by Assayas?
I thought it was executed perfectly, to be honest. I left the cinema feeling changed somewhat. It might sound slightly hyperbolic, but I thought the tension and the... intensity of what he was putting across was amazing.
Bridget, I'll come to you. As Ben seriously loved it. Did you share his same feelings? Did you feel really thrown into the film?
Yes, it was fascinating to watch. It was quite very slow to start and slow to reveal the different aspects of her life. But I was just mesmerised by the way she was trying to make a connection and the way she was struggling to sort of communicate at all different levels throughout the film.
Communication is quite a strong theme in the film. Obviously, there's Kristen Stewart's character wanting to communicate with her deceased brother. There's Skype conversations with her boyfriend who is in Oman. There's and these text messages that become quite a central part of the film. I feel like the film is quite multifaceted in that there's quite a lot going on. And for me, I was disconnected with that because I didn't think that all these different elements were joined up in a way that I could get fully involved with what was going on.
I can see how people would get that reaction. All I can say was that for such a singular narrative of a girl trying to find her brother, you know, I thought there was so much going on and every part of it washed over me so well. Mm. I thought, you know, it's about being isolated and maybe lost. You know, it's about being in another country and your career and your relationships with people and, you know, our relationship with technology and, you know, how you grieve, how you move on. Like you said, so much there. But I never felt overwhelmed. I loved it.
Mark, I'll come to you. You have seen the film, yeah?
I have, yeah.
Yes. So would you agree with that? You felt that, you know, it all joined up quite together? Because I'm going back into the same point here, but, you know, particularly when you've got the element of the ghost story, which felt a bit like something from a traditional horror film, and then you mix it up with this kind of weird thing that's going on, someone's texting her, and there's all this happening. I felt like it didn't quite join up, but what would you say?
For me as a whole, yeah, generally it did. I did kind of see it as a whole. The kind of issue that I have, and it's just a sort of personal thing, is towards the ending there was a couple of things that happened that I couldn't entirely sort of get, really, I suppose. It sort of seemed a little bit at odds with how the rest of the film had been put together, you know, because it's quite it's a slow burn, it's quite meticulous, and then there's certain things that happen that kind of almost require a bit of a leap of faith, as it were, which seemed at odds with how what I'd seen previously. But apart from that, I felt it held together pretty well, and it was the different elements, I thought, was quite intriguing, because you never knew which way it was going to go next, mm-hmm. and what was going to happen next, and, you know, where it was kind of going as well. It was kind of intriguing throughout. So I kind of liked all those different elements to it, because it wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just all creepiness. It wasn't all kind of just straight drama. You know, it was a nice variety, and I kind of liked that about it.
And there were bits, to the film's credit, that I found very creepy. Now, I am a wimp. I don't do horror. And I was sitting with my coat over my face for several sequences in the film. Let's talk about sort of the use of sound, the use of eeriness, how that all comes to play. Rosie, I'll come to you. As in terms of sort of the bits that are quite, you know, typical of a horror genre, that's done quite well, isn't it?
It's done really well. It gets incredibly tense at times, and particularly with the sort of text messaging. You know, there's a moment where she starts to receive a sequence of text messages, and I mean, I thought it was really well done in terms of kind of where we are today with digital technology and how it's sort of become such a huge part of our lives. And, you know, that was very sort of, dare I say, a sort of Hitchcock style moment of thrilling tension. It was, yeah, really. And I think what's really interesting is the kind of the fluctuation between the scenes where she's in that kind of fashion world and it's all very superficial and she's trying on these fantastic glittering dresses, and then the sort of very eerie scenes in Dark House where she's trying to make some sort of connection with her brother's spirit and with other spirits. And there's a lot of really interesting contrasting sort of bits of imagery going on, which I think I was sort of trying to understand what I felt about it earlier, and I was saying, to me it felt a little bit like you know, reading a poem or looking at a painting. Mm. You kind of come away with it, like I think Ben was saying, you come away with a feeling, and kind of you, it makes you ask a lot of questions, but it doesn't necessarily give you any answers. Mm-hmm. And
I completely agree with that. It doesn't give you, you know, a nice little tied up bow at the end. You take from this what you want, like if you were going to an art museum and looking at a piece of art on a wall. And I love that. So maybe I loved it so much because I created something in my head about it, but if that's what it makes you do, you know.
Yeah, and you know, perhaps it is what you take away from basically what's there. Let's talk about Kristen Stewart, actually, because she very much carries this entire film. She is the focal point of the film. And I actually think she's rather brilliant. Bridget, what would you say about her performance in the film?
Yes, well, last fortnight we had the Kristen Stewart is so underrated conversation, so we don't need to do that again. She's not the polished, confident young woman that you'd expect to be working in the fashion world. She's so out of place in everything she does. She's got this, like, chronically underslept look about her, and she's haunted and she's anxious, and she sort of taps her fingers on things. She's really physically inhabiting that role.
She's not at peace at all, is she?
No.
She does play that very well. I was just thinking, because I need to get this out. What is the film about? Because
that's something, as I was watching it, I've got all these notes written down, like tonal shifts, mm-hmm. and it is, you're right, it is all over the place. All these things happen that aren't related. And as I was going through, even like the first half of the film, I was, what is this film about? Is it a horror? Is it a thriller? What's going on? And it wasn't until I got to the end and I started to process it all that I could see the common themes and how things had been woven together. But it's not something that you recognise at the beginning. It's not laid out for you neatly at all. And I can see how it could just be haphazard.
I think it's quite important to see that they're marketing it as a horror film. I saw the trailer after seeing the film, and I can't recommend enough not seeing the trailer first, because it sells it as a hard ghost story, and I just didn't think it was. I thought it was a film about grief and like a drama.
Yeah, there are some... I do think there are some really interesting elements to the film. For me, it doesn't matter that it has all these different layers as such, but I think, Mark, you were saying about the ending, a couple of things that happened at the ending, and we talked about, you know, it doesn't need to have this nice tied-up bow at the end, but for me, it was kind of a bit like an anti-climax. I still felt that I didn't really understand the crux of the film. Maybe I'm not supposed to. Mark, do you
want
to weigh in on that?
Yeah, well, so the ending itself, as you say, is quite sort of ambiguous, and I was okay with that. It was more the scenes leading up to that beforehand. So I can't really go into detail because I'm giving things away. Confused me a little bit, and kind of for a while it kind of annoyed me because I was thinking too much about that, and then it was only sometime afterwards I started to think about the other elements of the film that and come together, and that was, as I say, that's a personal thing, that was for me. But as I say, the ending it is ambiguous, but I think that's in keeping with the kind of the way the film is building, and that, as I say, I didn't have a particular problem with that.
Can I just say first thing I did when I left the cinema was I called my sister, and we had about a 20-minute conversation about the film. She's not seen it, but yeah, it's it definitely made me want to talk to my sister.
Well, plenty of talking points. As you can see, everyone in this room except me really loved it. I didn't mind it. Anyway, Personal Shopper opened last week and it is still showing for a few screenings at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15. While its Oscar win for Best Foreign Film made an important political statement out of new release The Salesman, the film itself features no politics at all. Instead, like all the work of director Asghar Farhadi, the film depicts the cracks that can suddenly appear in domestic life. Set in the crumbling suburbs of Tehran, The Salesman starts with the walls literally falling in as young couple Emad and Rana Etesami have to flee their apartment after it becomes dangerously unsound. Their new apartment seems suitable enough, though the previous tenant never returns to remove her old belongings. Then, one evening, Rana, played by Tarana Aladusti, is attacked by an intruder. While she is left injured and horribly shaken, her husband, played by Shanab Hosseini, feels a growing need for an act of revenge. To help review The Salesman, we've brought Day Moybi into the studio, back from her travels. Good to have you back, Day.
Hi, it's good to be back. It's good to be back.
Excellent. Let's talk about The Salesman. Fahd Hardy, in his last film, A Separation, this film has got similar acclaim, and he's very good at portraying drama and about relationships and these sorts of themes. How well does he do this with The Salesman?
I think the technical ability of Fahd Hardy cannot be denied. He has this precise longing shots which just leave you waiting and longing for more. And his ability to do that throughout the whole film and create this intensity, which is subtle and parallels what's going on in the film, is just beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful.
I think a key thing I really like about his films is that it's very tense. There's a lot of, you know, there is a lot of emotional drama, but it's very restrained the way it's portrayed. There's not a lot of shouting. There's not these outbursts of emotion. It's all very kind of kept in, and that sort of adds to the drama. And Bridget, I'll come to you.
Yes, something that struck me about the film is there are a lot of things that can't be said. You can say some things to some people and some things to other people, but you just can't describe certain things that happen. I don't know, because there'd be a feeling of shame or because action would have to be taken.
Shame is quite a key theme in the film, or more people's attitudes. So we've got this previous tenant. When the couple move in, there's a previous tenant they don't know about. Then they find out more things about her, and there's this sort of judgment that comes on the previous tenant, or, you know, on other characters in the film. As an audience, are we asked to judge these people, or are we left sort of to take from it what we can?
I think we're left to take from it what we can. I think Fahadi does a really good job at allowing us to be empathetic towards both the characters and allow us to grow our empathy rather than judging the shame which takes place. And especially with it being cast with Miller, Arthur Miller being the death of a salesman, taking part with the shame of masculinity. And then this taking part with how Emad goes and he decides to take this route of revenge and the shame of not being able to discuss women's violence, you know, which I think is reflected in Iranian society, but also our own, in the growth of what can really be discussed and what is the case of what it means to be a victim, or just to be a victim to the constraints of society, I think is a really important element of the film.
Another aspect of being judgmental is if you had come to early decisions about who was wrong and who was right, your assumptions are changed so much throughout the film that always new bits of information coming that people have either concealed for good reasons or bad.
If we talk about how we look at the characters and how they sort of judge their actions, coming back to a point you were making about talking about violence against women and these themes, I felt like I wanted to see more of Rana's character. I wanted a bit more perspective from her character. I feel like Emad is very much the main character. And, you know, it's done brilliantly. I'm not saying it's not, but I was wanting more from Rana because she is the one who is assaulted. It's her story, but I feel like it's not quite coming from her perspective.
But then I think that's what was intentional, to the fact of it was the death of a salesman with Miller and seeing how Emad was reflecting and playing Willie, which is masculine shame and humility. And then having Rana, who is both, she's powerful, but she cannot say anything, which is this silence which places in the fact of what a woman can say and what a woman feels comfortable to say, you know, which is, I thought, was really important in the film, because as much as she keeps quiet and you don't see her having these like outbursts of this is what happened, because she can't say this is what happened. And in the moments of when it happens throughout the world, you don't know what to say. You know, the shame is something which she feels belongs to her because she will be questioned. Because just the act in itself is something which leaves her feeling vulnerable. And he and Imad is so consumed by himself. Like in the final scenes when it's like, this is an act of revenge. It's this is not for me. You know, for like she has to deal with everything by herself and she's dealing with it by herself and she's asking to be comforted, but he wants something to be done so he can say he's done it, I think, for...
Yes, and I think that's what is quite an interesting aspect to the film. Emad as a character is acting as the person who's going to make everything right. And actually, we see snippets of it before... sort of the climax towards the end of the film. There's a scene I'm thinking about when he's in the school and there's a boy who has taken a picture of him and he takes his phone and he says, oh, go and get your father and we'll talk about these photos. Just he as a character is somebody who wants to do things, to make things right. And I think that does come into play with what you were saying about masculinity. There are lots of different angles to this film where even after, it's so thought-provoking. Which is really a testament to Farhadi. Bridget, if you want to add anything.
And I watched A Separation for the first time shortly after watching The Salesman, so I can see a lot more the complex moral choices that seem to be typical of Farhadi's work. It's difficult for Imad because he's frustrated. He wants to make things right, but it's difficult to make things right if you don't know necessarily exactly what's wrong and if people aren't letting you in to fix things.
And I suppose at the end, going back to we take from the film what we kind of want to, we still don't really know the full details of what's happened. It's quite, you know, not wholly, but it is quite ambiguous. And I can see how for some people that might be frustrating. For me, personally, it worked really, really well. And I'm still thinking about the film after seeing it. Day, I know you took quite a lot from that. Can we talk about that last, without spoiling anything, that last section of the film? There's something that really throws off. We were just having quite a long discussion about it before the show. How we look at the characters based on their actions. And how much does that complement the film?
Oh.
Or not complement, because this is what we were discussing before, and I think it's a really interesting talking point.
Yeah, no, I think the like final epilogue reflects so much of how they each deal with one another. You know, even when the salesman played by... Hosseini, who's amazing, who's just fantastic, when he falls sick, he doesn't call the ambulance. And then you have this moment of, yet again, the shame reflected, you know, and not wanting to speak. And the fact of Rana's becomes, her silence becomes Imad's fight and it becomes our pain. And it becomes this huge conclusion, which kind of stabs you in the stomach, but not in this way in which you feel like, violated, but more in which you are filled with all of this simple complexity about what it means to have ordinary drama and to feel like you must still go on, because they each, with everything happening, with the family coming, with everything, they all still need to keep on moving. You know, they can't be still. Rana cannot be filled by the fact of this is her new home, so she, and yet again this violence, this pain is being brought to her, you know. And Imad can't deal with the fact of it's not going the way he wanted to. You know, he's not getting this feeling of satisfaction, you know. And then you have the salesman who's also stuck in himself, who's really who you meet and you realize is just weak, who to me is, he's the one who I, at the end, when I feel really sorry for him. And not because it's like, oh, poor you, but really in just the fact of everyone becomes victims of their own condition. And this final epilogue is just, it's like handed to you on a plate. And it's like, what do you see? Which I think the film just constantly brings more questions.
When we talk about the assault and the action, and then when we realise the character that has done this, relating to what you've said about feeling empathy for the characters and understanding, I found it quite hard that the action that character committed, which is inexcusable, I'm not sure it was treated. And I, perhaps this is intentional, going on the ambiguity and you take what you can from the film. But Bridget, I know you were discussing this with me about, he's done something quite terrible, and yet it's when it comes to the conversation and the reveal, it sort of slips away from...
Yes, he's trying to deny everything as much as possible until he's confronted with proof that he was at a place in a time, or that this happened or that that happened. And only when he's completely cornered does he give an apology of sorts, and yet it's still not complete and we still don't know what happened completely.
When it comes to that sort of cornering and, you know, look, face up to what you've done. You've done this inexcusable, atrocious act. And yes, of course, we can feel empathy for you because of your situation, and we can feel... But
Yes, and he's apologising, but it's not heartfelt. And what I had trouble with is the filmmaker trying to make us feel sorry for him and forgive him for the things that he might have done?
For me, I take it in this grey field of, rather than trying to understand... The way I understand it is that this shame is in all of the characters, in us not being able to speak about it, because you can't speak about the act and he can't speak about himself. And I think in just general violence towards women, we need to understand that even the men who do these inexcusable acts, you know, these are also men, and they're not just these people who are peering underneath women's skirts, but also through their own conditioning. They don't realise what is happening, what is going on. And in these facts of, it's easy to cast every man, whoever has done any excuse, anything against a woman, as a villain. But really understanding the fact that we need to talk about it is, not every man who does this is a villain, but he has done an act which we need to talk about in order to stop the silence, in my personal opinion.
And I didn't feel he was a villain. I don't think he is a villain. I just think... For what he did, I'm not sure that there was enough, or perhaps that it just felt like that was kind of left on the side afterwards. Because there was all this drama going on in that sequence. We're going a lot into detail here, but, you know, there's all this going on in that sort of 10-minute sequence. And I feel like, well, actually, the thing that he did, it's kind of... It's not as important anymore. I don't know. It left me conflicted. And I guess that's part of the film's... Sorry, Bridget. Carry on.
It felt like he was sorry he got found out, but not sorry that he did it.
Very good. Yes, I kind of see that. Day?
Yeah, I can see that point. But I think it's... Especially with, like, the shot of the chairs at the end, which is, like, this... It's a conversation which needs to happen rather than a blame. You know, and it's the case of what happens when it's like she's also going to, Rana's also going to be questioned, and he needs to be questioned. And I understand, I didn't feel as if it was like, poor me and I'm sick. I didn't feel any of this, but rather that his own conditioning as a man has left him limited, especially in Iranian society and what is expected of a woman. This takes part as well as, like, so you have to cast of what it is to be a woman, and then you cast of what it is to be a man. And even in his discussion with Imad, he's like, I'm old enough to be your father. You know, there's this moment, you know, of how you treat each other, which is like sometimes we have this thing in Western society. But I really think that the film tries to go beyond any cast of black and white morality, which is why, like, Farhad is a composer of, like, empathy. Really, he truly did something spectacular here, in my opinion.
And I don't know what the laws are like in Iran. I mean, certainly in a separation, there was an aspect of the law that would cause great harm or great imprisonment if something was admitted. I don't know what the impact would be of this sort of assault being talked about openly.
And I think that's what the film touches on. I mean... All we've talked about, I think, just shows what I actually, you know, I really loved this film, and what I do think is a strength of the film. That last sequence in particular, I felt, as a piece of social commentary, that was actually kind of a masterstroke, because, you know, we've been talking about it in great detail. We've got all these different talking points, all these different elements. And I think, as you said, this is what Farhadi does so, so, so well. And it's the strength of the film as a whole.
And it's
subtle.
It's subtle. It's so subtle.
It is the jeweler's screwdrivers that have put it all together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Oh, wow.
Salesman opened last week and still has some showings at the Arts Picture House. Plus, it's available to see online via the Curzon online service. In a couple of weeks, we'll finally see the general release of Free Fire, the sixth film from director Ben Wheatley. A change of pace after the grand Guignol social commentary of High Rise, Free Fire is a simple shoot-'em-up with Brie Larson, Armie Hammer and Cillian Murphy all part of a firearm sale. This coming Wednesday, that's the 29th of March, there's a chance to see the film early with a special preview screening at the Arts Picture House. After the showing, there'll be a live Q&A with Ben Wheatley. To preview this preview, it seemed a good idea to rerun our interview with Ben Salisbury, who with Jeff Barrow composed and designed the music for Free Fire. Interviewed at the Water Sprite Student Film Festival last year, Ben had just started working on the Free Fire score when Toby Miller spoke to him about the ins and outs of writing film music.
Film, by its very nature, it's an interpretation of the world, and I suppose music could be argued is the most extreme example of the unreality of that version of the world. The film I last worked on that's been released, Ex Machina, had some very interesting examples of music being hopefully invisible, or at least not overtly noticeable, gradually ramping up the claustrophobia and the tension, and those are really tricky parts to work on, but very satisfying if you're into film and you know that you're subtly affecting the way people are viewing a character's conversation. You know that you're by a shift in key or a change of sound or subtle sonics, you're changing the way a dramatic scene is playing out and being perceived, but you're not making yourself, your presence known. Those are great things to be involved in.
You mentioned it there and you mentioned it in the talk, your scoring partnership with Jeff Barrow, and the fact that your ideas would occasionally collide and it would spark something else. And the importance of that as a co-authoring relationship. Is that chance for difference an importance with the director as well?
Yeah, no, and that's why Ex Machina was so satisfying to work on. Where music's concerned, it was a three-way collaboration between me, Jeff and Alex Garland. Alex would be the guy who makes the final decision, but we were quite within our sort of remit, if you like, to say, I'm not sure it should be so tense here. You know, as far as I'm thinking, you know, Caleb's not understood that Nathan's doing this here or whatever. And Alex would go, you sure? I've always thought that, you know, and Alex took all of those sort of conversations on board.
You mentioned the important relationship between a composer and the director.
Yeah.
But I was wondering about the relationship that a composer might have with the audience.
There is, that's, again, very good question. You know, you are doing this with the audience in mind. You know, you need to subvert them, you need to lead them slightly in the wrong direction, you need to occasionally lead them in the right direction and really bolster that strand of the narrative. And funnily enough, in Ex Machina, because it's a sci-fi film, people are aware of Android films. They've been a Hollywood, you know, cinema trope for, you know, a long time. And in the same way, there's sci-fi music has its tropes. So you can play on them. You can, you know, obviously for me and Jeff, John Carpenter, for both of us, is a big influence. And we were very overtly influenced by John Carpenter for the stuff we started writing for Dread that eventually became our album, Drock. So, yeah, we're hopefully constantly aware of how the audience would perceive things stylistically. And again, that's one of the places I really bow to sort of Jeff's sort of sensibility in terms of really getting to the sort of crux of how tiny sonic aspects in music can trigger certain resonances with the audience, you know.
We don't get very many scores that really stand out. We have, as you mentioned, Under the Skin or Johnny Greenwood's scores. Mm-hmm. Punch Drunk Love is another one where the score is almost opposite the film.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a direction that films could go? They could be a little bit more adventurous with what they're doing, and that will develop.
It will develop, and it is developing, and I think me and Jeff are in doing this at quite a exciting time, and those scores that you pointed out were not only for successful films, they were successful scores. Putting music and sound and together with the moving image, the possibilities are endless into how, you know, it's something that I'm sure Mozart or Beethoven or, you know, they'd dreamed about the possibilities. And, you know, I'm sure there are people, there's going to be people out there who might change the rules completely. I don't know what that might be. You know, you're always working within the remit of the film you're working for. So the one we're doing at the moment, Ben Wheatley's Free Fire, it has a need to be period. You know, we realised that early on.
Why does it necessarily have the need to be period? I'm thinking of Inglourious Basterds, where the needle drops, for want of a better word, are out of period. Again, I suppose it depends on the film's relationship with the audience, the relationship it's after.
I think it's because it's in a very self-contained world. It's in this warehouse. It takes place in a warehouse. Most of the action takes place in almost real time. You don't want to be thrown out of that. The music is very notable in some places, but it's probably going back to this, you know, within the artifice that is film music, you can either really ramp up that artifice, really if we suddenly put a piece of Mozart or Bach over the guns firing or whatever, you'd really notice that you'd be taken out of the film. And I think that's the point, is that we wanted to find music that, whilst sometimes very in your face, didn't take you away from the self-contained nature of the film. So I think that's the reason. It's the first time I've tried to articulate it, so I need to think about that more for when the film comes out.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Ben Salisbury for the interview, which we originally ran on Bums on Seats last year. The preview screening of Free Fire with Ben Wheatley Q&A will be this coming Wednesday at 8:50 in the evening. More details are available via the Cambridge Arts Picture House website.
I'm Mandy Morton.
And I'm Nicola Robson.
And collectively we present
The Eclectic Light Show,
a monthly arts magazine featuring
the very best in
theatre, music, film, books
and celebrity interviews.
Join us on the first Sunday of every month
from 2 till 4
on community radio
in your city.
Cambridge 105.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Meanwhile, back here on the good ship Bums on Seats, we're still the lost city of Zed, but first, we got to meet the parents.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, I'm just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and hug me, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Are you ready for this?
I'm back in the beat.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb. But it's cool. Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here. Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out!
Yo!
Continuing the tradition of American horror movies offering a good dose of social commentary, new release Get Out uses its scare tactics to explore US race relations. Written and directed by Jordan Peele, Get Out stars Daniel Kaluuya as Chris Washington, a young black man on a weekend trip to meet the parents of his white girlfriend Rose. But Rose, played by Allison Williams, admits that she hasn't even informed her parents that her boyfriend is black, a fact that seems all the more inopportune when Chris discovers the household has African-American servants. Bridget, Get Out is a film. It's got a lot of publicity. It's very, very popular. It's got 99% on Rotten Tomatoes. It seems that everybody loves it. Do you love it? And why do you think everybody loves it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. I loved it.
Perfect.
It felt to me really fresh and contemporary. It's got a good blend of comedy and horror. Right from the beginning, you know it's a horror film because of an attack that they show. And then it changes tone into this much more everyday paranoia of meeting the parents for the first time. And when they're weighing you up like horse flesh, are you suitable for their daughter? Is it the ordinary paranoia that you might feel, or is there something else going on? And they just skirt on the edge of this so well, with so many humorous moments and so much awkward formality of white liberals trying to be unoffensive and welcoming to somebody that's dating their daughter. There was a lot going on. I loved it.
You brought up a lot of points there. I'm going to try and treat a few of them with everybody else. So how does the film stand up, A, as a piece of horror cinema, but also as a piece of political commentary? Rosie, I'm looking at you.
That's quite a big question.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to say, in all honesty, I have watched very few horror films in my life, much like you. I'm not a big fan, so I can't really compare it to many others. However, I thought the fact... I think it says a lot about the film that I really enjoyed it, even though I was really terrified. I thought it was fantastic, really. I mean, I know the main actor, I think he's called Daniel Kaluuya. Mm-hmm. He was in Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror episode, 50 Million Merits. And I thought there was a lot of similarities, actually, with the tone of this and with that. There's a real sort of dark humour running through it. But there's also that very creepy sort of Twilight Zone-y, just really, really unsettling feel, mm-hmm. which I thought he got absolutely bang on. I was really on the edge of my seat, but I was also genuinely quite entertained throughout. His best friend's a fantastic character. He brings a lot of comedy to the whole sort of situation. So, yeah, sorry, I can't remember what your second question was.
As a piece of political commentary,
we can
come back to that.
Okay.
Because I just want to say, Ben, you're a massive fan of horror.
I am.
So we've heard it from the point of view of people who don't like horror so much. What about from someone who loves horror?
Yeah, this is fantastic. So if you look at classic horror films, a lot of them are social commentaries. So if you go back to sort of George Romero with Night of the Living Dead, that was his reaction to the Vietnam War, things like that. Jordan Peele, the director and the writer, he comes from a comedy background, and I think he did something really interesting here, and that's why it feels so fresh, because I think he made a traditional horror with so much inside it that, yeah, it becomes something else altogether. I mean, it's really funny. I thought this film was funnier than most comedies I've seen this year.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've had that same reaction.
Yeah, I was laughing a lot.
And the best comedy the best comedy does that, yes. You're laughing and then you're terrified minutes later. It's brilliant.
There's something quite satirical about it. And
I kind of want to talk actually about the sort of political statement that it's making. Mark, I'm going to come to you, particularly at this time, let's say in America. You know, we are in the era of Trump. It seems quite, you know, poignant that a film like this is coming out. But what I did find very interesting about it is that the villains of the film, you know, they're not sort of skinheads or neo-Nazis. They're liberal Americans. How do you think that works in the context of the wider film?
Yeah, it's kind of, it sort of always adds to the creepiness of it in a way, and how sort of unnerving it is, because they aren't what you would expect those kind of villains to be, really. They're far more, it's quite sort of subtle, and as has already been alluded to, you're not quite sure exactly what's going on and where it's kind of going. Then it becomes apparent that there is something clearly amiss, but everyone seems so sort of, in a creepy way, kind of so nice and so liberal. So it's kind of interesting how that so sort of makes it more sinister in a way, I think, and more creepy. Okay. As the film goes on, as things start to unfold, and we see what's going on, and it's an interesting question, because when you think about the motivation and what's actually done, obviously you can't really say too much, you don't really give anything away, but it's a sort of it's kind of an admiration and a contempt for the black man, basically, and which in itself is quite interesting, because that seems paradoxical, really. So it's an interesting sort of thought there on the perception of, you know, of the black man and how these people kind of, what they do with that, basically. Mm. And as it unfolds, you know, it's obviously quite ghastly.
I think there was a term I read in an article which A, made me laugh, but also kind of reveals how sinister the whole thing is. I think it was called benevolent racism was the term used to talk about this film, which does make it sort of all the more sinister. I do think it's a very interesting way in which the film explores the relationship between horror and racism, because racism in itself is a horrific thing, and I don't think personally I've seen something, you know, I've seen a lot of films about racism, I don't think I've seen it treated in such a way before, and it really, really works. Bridget, I'm just coming to you now.
Yes, it's as if they go on about how amazing the African American people are, and they would vote for Obama for a third term, but there is an element of
Tiger Woods.
Yes, but what they're useful for? They have people who work for them, and they're great, wonderful people with great skills and strengths who can be useful.
There's a really interesting scene when one of the guests goes up to him, doesn't he, and feels his muscles and thing, and you immediately think that is so wrong on so many levels.
The racism that people are unaware that is racism.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Ignorance, but. That also there's a common trope in horror where the African American in the group will end up dying inadvertently, and there's always been that joke. Whereas this is the polar opposite, isn't it?
And his friend Rod from the TSA.
Yes,
Rod works at the TSA and he's his best mate, and he's looking after his dog while he's away visiting the parents.
Every scene he's in is just golden, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean the way that it mixes typical horror tropes, as you said, with such comedic elements, I think is very much admirable. To try and give something slightly negative, but maybe not. Mark, I know I was speaking to you earlier. You mentioned, we're not going to spoil anything here, but you mentioned something about the ending or the last portion of the film. What were your reservations there?
I didn't really have any particular reservations as such, only that I wouldn't necessarily say it's a huge criticism. It's not really a criticism, more of an observation that some of the build out is all a lot of concentrated towards the end. What it's building up to, and when we sort of finally see what's kind of going on, and there's the action, so to speak, it is kind of concentrated in that final section. But I wouldn't say that detracts from the film, though. It's not really a criticism, just an observation that it all happens that way, and it happens fairly quickly as well.
That's it. I felt the same way. So with Personal Shopper, where it's very an ambiguous ending, you take what you want, this wraps it up very quickly, you know, at the end, and you leave going, that's that story completed now.
Mm. Funnily enough, I quite like that.
Yes. Well, I loved it. You all loved it. So great thumbs up from us. Get Out opened last week and is now showing at both The View and Light Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 15. Our last film of the show takes us deep into the Amazonian rainforest for the lost city of Zed, the true story of Victorian-era adventurer Colonel Percival Fawcett. Charlie Hunnam stars as Colonel Fawcett, an ex-military man who becomes fascinated with the possibility that the impenetrable jungle of the Amazon Basin hides the ruins of a forgotten civilization. This notion, which flies in the face of the accepted theories of human development, wins Fawcett few friends, but he's relentless in his pursuit, leading expedition after expedition into the mysterious and dangerous jungle.
I'll not know you when you return.
I know this is a sacrifice for all of us.
The environment's brutally difficult. The journey may well mean your life, but you could reclaim your family name.
Ain't nobody comes back from up there.
But we have never let fear determine our future.
What did you hope to achieve out here?
If we may find a hidden civilization, where one was considered impossible to exist, we may well write a whole new chapter in history. I call it Zed. It is there. And we must find it.
Ben, let's talk about Lost City of Zed. It's sort of marketed as this great exploration drama. Did you enjoy it?
I loved it, yeah. It was a really strong week for me, actually. I loved all these films. But, I've really, really got into the adventure of this. It's not a story I knew much about, so I was looking at it as more as a learned experience as well.
Yeah. Bridget, you've seen this film. I think it started off a little bit slow. Before we get into the sort of action and the first expedition, there's about half an hour where I found it a bit slow, a little bit boring. Don't like to use that word. How did you feel? Were you thrown from the beginning?
At the beginning, it did remind me of the Victorian novels, which have 60 chapters and they're all terribly, terribly short. and they all describe a moment. So this is the moment when he has arrived back from the war and he doesn't have a medal, and this is the moment where we meet his wife. And it was a relief when we did get some more extended pieces, although I think they mostly happened in the jungle.
It was interesting that, because I think maybe they were trying to set up the character a bit more, which wasn't entirely necessary. You know, we wanted to see the adventure down the, you know, the Amazon. And yeah, they were treating it more as like a biopic, maybe, and trying to give him his background.
Well, it was a true story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah. If we're talking about the biopic of this character, and I will say I did like this film, I don't know if I found Percy as a character very charismatic or engaging. I was far more interested in Robert Pattinson's character. How much does this weigh in on the film for you?
150%. I mean, Charlie Hunnam, bless him, he can't act.
Honestly, well, that's not what I was saying, Ben.
Well, no. I'll say it to his face, I'm sorry. But I just thought he was awful. I think he was terrible in this.
But this didn't detract. You loved the film.
I did. Mainly because of Sienna Miller and Robert Pattinson and all the supporting actors who are phenomenal. And the story, obviously. But yeah, I thought it felt like he was reading the words phonetically rather than understanding what he was saying.
And Bridget, what do you agree with this?
No, I mean, it took me a long while to sort of get the heart and soul of the film, but I thought it was really interesting what he was going through, his motivations, because he wants to get medals and he wants to get reputation, and he's an outcast. He's not one of the military class. He's not at home in the military. He's not at home in the jungle. but he's learnt to do leadership. He's learnt to perform leadership and perform in the military way.
Sure.
But there's stuff behind his eyes. There's a depth and a quickness that I kept seeing there all the time. He's trying to work out where he is and what he's doing, what the right thing is.
Sure.
And he only relaxes at home with his wife, and there's a scene later on when his son is quite a bit older, and that's the only time he really settles in.
I think it was supposed to be, it was Brad Pitt at first, then he went on as a producer, and then it was Benedict Cumberbatch, who then got outed when he went to Doctor Strange. So I do feel it was a bit like, well, third strike and you're out. And you're right, though. I mean, the character was very interesting, but I just thought he didn't play it particularly well, personally.
Can we not relate that, though, and this, I have two kind of sizable issues with the film. First, I guess, is a structural thing, and in terms of the narrative, it's quite episodic. You know, he goes on this expedition, he comes back, he goes on another expedition, he comes back, he goes to war, which is fine, you know, because we're interested in the expeditions. That's what the whole film is about. But there were some elements of sort of pacing that didn't quite tie up, you know, in terms of like, where does this obsession with the lost city of Zed come from? Why his kid one minute, you know, really hates him, the next minute his kid is wanting to go on an expedition with him? Did you not find these kind of flaws in sort of structure?
Now you mention it, the more you talk about it, the more those were quite apparent flaws. I don't know. I did get washed up in it. I saw it with a friend of mine, and he didn't like it half as much as I did. I think he was quite bored. I did enjoy it a lot more than most, I think.
But I didn't think it was boring.
Right. Okay.
I just think that structurally it didn't quite work for me. It's not boring, and I think a lot of that comes from the portrayal of the jungle. It's visually, it's really well
done. Stunning,
isn't
it? Yeah.
Bridget, I don't know what you think in terms of structure or cinematography or both.
What I was thinking structurally is, if this was a novel rather than a real person's story, is I'd be saying, as an editor, cut the war, it doesn't add anything.
Yes.
But you can't really do that when it's such a major part of people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah, they kind of had to add that bit in. But again, because the film is episodic, it is a bit sort of randomly in between the three expeditions, and you're kind of thinking, like you say, let's just get over that bit and go to the next.
And he gives this really weird motivational speech in the trenches, which is totally not like what a proper army person would say, but is really in keeping for him, because he's, as I was saying earlier, he's just not really part of that cadre.
My other issue with the film, actually, is in the portrayal and the attitude towards the portrayal of the sort of native groups that Percy comes across when he gets to South America. And I couldn't quite work out what the attitude is. And this kind of relates to the ending. So I feel like they're trying to make a mockery of, at that time, how the British saw these murderous savages, in quotes, being like, oh, well, now, we wouldn't think like that anymore. And I feel like they're trying to mock it. However, I'm not going to spoil anything, but the ending of the film and what happens, I feel, completely turns that on its head. I can't go into details, but do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, no, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, I just think that if you're going to treat such a topic, and if you're going to make reference to how these native peoples are portrayed in the film, then choosing that ending was quite a dangerous move. And I don't think they quite got there with how they wanted to portray the relationship between the British and the peoples in South America. Does anyone have anything? You're both looking at me like, oh gosh.
Well, no, you pretty much hit the nail on the head there. It was quite a, I wouldn't even say brave decision. It does seem slightly misguided. It does make you think, doesn't it?
Yeah. I tell you what, on that note, we'll move on. The Lost City of Zed opened yesterday, March the 24th, and is now screening at both the Arts Picture House and the Light Cinema. It is a Certificate 15. And And that is all we have time for on the show today, sadly. The past hour will be repeated this coming Monday at 11 o'clock. There'll also be a podcast with extra interview and extra reviews, which I know you're all dying to hear, available on Tuesday from both our page on the Cambridge 105 website and our page on iTunes. We will be back on air with a new show on Saturday, the 8th of April. On the programme will be reviews of Ben Wheatley's Free Fire, plus a look at Ghost in the Shell, the Japanese anime classic remade with Scarlett Johansson. Also due for release is A Quiet Passion, a biography of the poet Emily Dickinson from director Terence Davies. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everyone here on Bums on Seats, it's goodbye.